seconds, and we've had a go for auto sequence start. The SRB hydraulic power units have started. T-minus 21 seconds, and the solid rocket booster engine gimbal now underway. T-minus 15 seconds.
T-minus
10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff, and it has cleared the tower.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network calling.
The station with the happy difference.
And this is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the heartland and in the bunker. Ready for another big shoe here today, right here on our stage. Yeah.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581 is the address. Address your mail to either Box Holder or Tom Metzger or the Insurgent, and we'll get it, no matter which one you use. Yeah.
Well, there we are. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana. Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse also. And filling station where we sell only ethyl or regular. And that's right next to our weapons of mass destruction used equipment yard. We're almost closed down here. It's getting cool. And won't be long till we'll be shutting the doors and just partying all winter till spring. Yeah. And if you want to invest in the new renovation of Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse, and weapons of mass destruction used equipment yard, well, you just send your donations on to us or get your rich uncle to send a big bunch of money. Yeah. And you kids, go in the bedroom, find your dad's pants, find his billfold, empty it out, and send that to us too, okay? Well, I'll be damned. There's a mosquito in here, in the bunker. I thought all the mosquitoes were gone and dead and everything, but there's still one left alive, man. Up until a week ago, we was having a fly problem again here at the end of the summer. Warmed up enough that those damn flies come out. The only thing I have to get rid of them is fly strips. So you come into my house and it looks like the hanging weeds of Babylon hanging from the ceiling. It works. Fly strips. Spray, that's toxic. Yeah, don't want to use that stuff. But did you ever walk into one of those fly strips? Man, I'll tell you, it's hard to get out of them. They stick really good. You know, I think if we made them in bigger amounts, bigger, we could put them along the road out there in the black neighborhoods and catch those black guys before they do bad things on our human-sized fly paper. Well, it's time to get serious, boys and girls. Serious today, I was Laverne yesterday, yeah. Well, here's the question of the day. What does the Secret Service think of Donald Trump? This guy says, I have a neighbor in the Secret Service who I've become pretty friendly with, and as it happens, I asked the same question a few months ago. He told me that in general, the agents really like getting assigned to his protection detail. He explained that it's not because the agents particularly do or don't like one candidate or another. Part of the job is that they are committed to performing their duties regardless of who that individual is and what their personal opinion of the person might be. Instead, the reason he said agents are liking the assignment with Trump is the environment they find themselves in. As an example, he told me they usually fly around in government-owned planes. These planes are built by the lowest bidder and are equipped that way. There is little in the way of comfort or niceties. Trump, on the other hand, does not buy things like his personal jet based on who was the low bidder. Rather, he buys for his own preference, which means it is a whole lot more luxurious with a lot more creature comforts and a much more pleasant environment to spend time in. He also said that Trump treats the agents respectfully and seems to generally want them to be well taken care of. Again, that's obviously going to make the detail much nicer for one to work. As an aside, he did mention one item that usually has a big impact on how the agents feel about who they're protecting, which is punctuality. Apparently, the Clintons are notorious for running late and getting way off schedule, which can create a lot of challenges for the agents and increase stress levels substantially. He said that Obama is a world more timely than the Clintons ever were. And George H.W. Bush was so punctual you could set a watch to him. All of that said, he did repeatedly tell me that no matter who it is or how challenging the person may be to protect, the culture in the agency remains one that constantly reinforces the attitude that the job always gets done at the highest levels of quality, no matter what. Here's another question of the day. Why doesn't the U.S. Army use RPGs? I've got a bone to pick with some of the existing answers, although I think James Sevick hits pretty close to the mark. I don't think because the U.S. Army has better weapons is the answer here. In fact, the year-on-year, I'll wager the Soviets were equipped with better RPG-style weapons than we were throughout the Cold War. Let's pretend this is a college freshman's essay and begin to looking at the definition of an RPG. In English, that stands for rocket-propelled grenade. Quick pedantic argument over the difference between a grenade and a rocket. To make things even murkier, the RPG-7 is the launcher, not the grenade. The projectile itself has a different designation, such as PG-7V. In reality, rocket-propelled grenade is a backronym, and RPG stands for the Russian term. Best that I can tell, this means a handheld anti-tank grenade launcher. However, it is not clear what Granato grenade implies in terms of rocket propulsion. Soviet and Russian weapons called RPGs are both multi-shot and disposable. With rockets that burn completely in the barrel of the rocket, that keep burning throughout the entire flight, with rockets that fly slowly, and rockets that fly very fast indeed. Not speaking a lick of Russian, I'm going to compare some weapon systems mentioned in the previous answers to the Soviet called RPGs. So before I answer your question directly, let's talk about what is and what is not an RPG. Whoa. Showing a lot of pictures here. Handheld doesn't just mean small enough to be carried. It implies that the soldier fires the weapon offhand. So some goes for Malikitka, known as the AT-3 Sager within NATO. That's a U.S. Army FMG or FGM 148, a great piece of 90s vintage kit and highly intelligent IR guidance. It's comparable to a wide range of man-portable guided anti-tank missiles system produced by countries like Japan, Israel, Germany, China, France, and Russia, the United Kingdom, Croatia, the list goes on. It's not comparable to anything I've routinely called an RPG. Ditto, Marine Corps M47 Dragon. Which was in fact an utter crock of shit, according to everything I've ever read about it. Believe it or not, there's also a British Javelin 3, of which are shown below. It's not comparable because it's guided, but it's also not comparable because it's an anti-aircraft weapon. The Javelin refers to the missile, not the launcher. Javelin, in this case, is an American transliteration of the British word Gwaewaffen, which means a name that is astonishingly bad from a SEO perspective. So what about this? That's an RPO, Russian Lynx. Do we have a match? Let's run through the criteria. Handheld and fired? Nah. Unguided? Nah. Launcher? Name refers to launcher. Double yaw. Anti-tank? Her. I don't know what those words mean. I'm not sure they're saying yes they're good or yes they're bad. Actually, this weapon is classified as a flamethrower. It's in the same class as the Chinese FHJ-84, which is one better. Well, I'm not going to read this all to you. There's a lot of pictures with it too, so I'll send it to you, and you can pick out your choice for your Christmas under the Christmas tree. But if you don't get out of here pretty soon, and if we have it in stock, you won't have it for Christmas. So get on the ball here. When you come down here for your RPGs, your Chinese RPGs, make sure you bring plenty of money because they're not cheap. Well, this is an FYI message to you. American Jewish groups were among those congratulating President-elect Donald Trump on Wednesday after his poll-defying victory over Democratic Hillary Clinton in Tuesday's election. In a statement, Stephen M. Greenberg, chairman of the Conference of Presidents of the Major American Jewish Organizations, and Malcolm Honlein, the group's executive vice chairman, said they welcome Trump's clear commitment to be president of all Americans and to bind the wounds of division after a long and bruising campaign. The conference stands ready to contribute the hard work of healing the divides in our country, which were revealed at times in stark terms during the campaign. Furthermore, Greenberg at Honlein said, "We look forward to working with President-elect Trump and his advisors in the transition before his inauguration in the years to come during his presidency on issues facing our country, as well as a specific concern to the American Jewish community, including strengthening the special U.S.-Israel relationship, the rise of anti-Semitism, and the security of the Jewish people at home and abroad." Greenberg at Honlein also commended Clinton on her hard-fought campaign and extended our deepest gratitude for her lifelong accomplishments in the public service on behalf of the American people. The American Jewish Committee's CEO David Harris also extended well wishes to Trump and expressed hope his administration would take early steps to reach out to every American, including concerned minority groups across the land, reaffirming our links to our friends across the globe, and in the months and the years to come, advance peace, security, and prosperity for our nation and the world. Oh, isn't that nice? Speaking with the Al Jazeera magazine on Wednesday, Rabbi Abraham Cooper, Associate Dean of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles, said it's clear Trump will make a great supporter of the State of Israel and of commitment to the recognizing Jerusalem as the eternal unified capital of the Jewish people, even though the Palestinians were there first. The Simon Wiesenthal Center looks forward to working with Trump on a wide range of issues, first and foremost Israel, as well as Iran, human rights, anti-Jewism, and also the climate on U.S. campuses for Jewish students. Cooper continued, "It's going to be a full menu." we're going to have many requests of President Trump. In his victory speech, Cooper said Trump made a commitment to be president of all the people, including those who didn't vote for him, and many who are worried and fearful about the future course of the country. I think that this commitment to being healed process for what is a very fractured society is extraordinarily important. In a letter sent to Trump on Wednesday, Gary Saltzman, B'nai B'rith International President, that's the top of the pack there, boys, and Daniel Mariashin, the group's executive vice president, wrote, quote, among the pressing issues we know you will be facing in the coming months are domestic concerns as economy, health care, our immigration system, and the needs of American seniors. The challenges abroad are no less imposing as an unsettled Middle East, the threat of terrorism, and aggressively hostile Iran will surely command the concern attention by your administration. Well, there you go. It goes on for quite a ways. You know, wanted to make sure that Trump stays in line. I wonder if David Duke reads any of this stuff. Oh, God, it's funny. It's a funny thing. Also, I heard this morning that President Trump Trump is going to reinstall or keep the private prisons. That's bad news for our friends. So he's starting off on the wrong foot with me. He wants to keep those private prisoners because it makes a lot of money for some big people. And so I can see the billionaire attitude towards that. Well, I see Apex firmly behind him, too. And Matt Brooks, the executive director of the Republican Jewish Coalition, said in a statement the RJC could not be happier with the election of Donald Trump and our Senate and House majorities. That's interesting. Could not be happier, our Senate and House majorities. Historic victory for Republicans up and down the ticket is sound rejection of the failed policies of the Obama administration. See, the Jews weren't that happy with Obama. Not happy at all. Because he did stop them in several situations in the Middle East. He didn't do what they wanted him to do. However, Brooks went on to say, after a long, grueling campaign, it's time for the nation to come together. While there are bound to be bruises on both sides of the aisle, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents must move forward for the good of the country. In a statement by the Anti-Defamation League ADL National Chairman Marvin Nathan, and ADL CEO Jonathan Greenblatt said, we welcome Mr. Trump's pledge that he will be president of all Americans and he will seek the common ground of reconciliation that has been the hallmark of American elections and transitions that follow. This is all horseshit, of course you realize. It's all horseshit. So all these groups that goes on down here, there's Zionist Organization of America, you name it, they're all playing nice, saying nice things about Donald. I wish somebody would download this and send it to Plastic Man. He needs to know this stuff. However, these guys that run these organizations must not look at the polls too closely. This New York Times exit poll, 71 of Jews voted for Clinton. 24 back Trump. There you go. Well, let me quote some stuff here. Trump has promised to change all that. because they say, the Jews say, that Barack Obama was not their friend when it came to Israel. He wanted them to declare war on Iran, or they wanted to declare war on Iran, and he refused to do it. Trump has promised to change all that, and chances are he will significantly so. We will likely see an end to the current administration's deliberate daylight policy towards the Jewish state and the rightful return of Obama-aligned fringe groups like J Street to the political margins. There you go, blacks. The Trump campaign has promised to respond harshly to the UN's outrageous behavior towards Israel and to investigate organized anti-Israel hate groups on campus. A Trump administration is also likely to show far more respect for the will of the Israeli public on matters of peacemaking. Despite the occasional comment on the campaign trail, Trump has consistently expressed his affection for the Jewish state over almost 40 years. True, he has much to learn about the intricacies, and in some cases the basics, of Middle East geopolitics. But as president, he will have an army of agencies at his disposal to help with the education process. With regard to the Islamic Republic, despite bold assertions in the regime-controlled media that we don't really care who the next president will be, Trump's victory undoubtedly has overwhelmed the mullahs with trepidation. Welcome news indeed. Rest assured, we will now begin to see a different, more conciliatory tone from our Tehran effective immediately. Well, there you go, boys and girls. I don't see much anti-Israel stuff going on here with Mr. Trump. I told you before, when you see him speak, he uses these same mannerisms as businessmen, Jews, use in New York in the garment industry. The way he holds his hands. Watch him. Yeah. I predict Trump is going to go after anti-Semites or anti-Jews with a fervor that even Obama would not do. Quote, to be sure, though, Trump is surely no anti-Jew, a certain brand of parasitic Jew-hater, the cowardly kind, the kind that hides in the anonymous shadows of social media and preys on unsuspecting journalists with Jewish last names, has firmly latched onto his coattails. Were he to sharply kick them to the curb on his way into the Oval Office, it would lay the groundwork for a broad and constructive relationship with all the major Jewish groups throughout the course of his presidency. Do you catch that, boys and girls? Do you catch that? He's got his orders. Kick those anti-Semites or anti-Jews to the curb by any means possible. What's David Duke going to do about that? See, the problem is when you play that game of that the right-wing racial people are playing, it's like Briar Rabbit. Yeah, and Briar Rabbit and Tar Baby. He's going to take care of those tar baby Jews. First he gets his one paw on the tar baby and he can't get it loose. Then he gets another paw on the tar baby, he can't get loose. Then pretty soon he's got both feet and both paws stuck on tar baby and he can't get loose. Well, that's the way the right wing plays the game. And the tar baby is the Zionist Jew, and he gets them every time, man. Well, here's a little bit more on the Trump-Jewish question, where they criticize him for having some people get into his campaign that may be critical of the Jews. Remember this. Trump is the father of an Orthodox Jew and counts Jews among his closest advisors and supporters. Few other serious presidential candidates have had as up close or his personal experience with Jews or Judaism. Well, if you're a businessman in New York, are you kidding? You can't do business in New York without playing games with the Jews. The familiarity isn't going to make it any easier for him to build on the 30% of the Jewish vote that Mitt Romney received in 2012. During the primary season, Trump distinguished himself from his rivals through his taking maximalist stands on immigration enforcement, and particularly relating to Muslims and refugees from the Syrian Civil War. American Jews are not only politically liberal, but they are also sensitive to the dangers that vulnerable minority populations face both inside the United States and beyond. For some Jews, see, Jews look at everything from a Jewish point of view. Everything. For some Jews, Trump's proposed ban on Muslims entering the United States recalled earlier American movements to limit Jewish immigrants or to scapegoat American Jews for the country's social and political ills. Then there's a steady pattern of anti-Semitism-related incidents that have somehow involved the Trump campaign, a trend that continues to this day. There was Trump hesitance to reject the support of anti-Jew former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke, his failure to condemn supporters who had been sending anti-Jew death threats to journalist Julia Offe after she published a profile of Melania Trump in GQ, his habit of retweeting white supremacists and the use of the slogan America First, which has an anti-Semitic provenance. Most recently, there was a promulgation of the anti-Jew, anti-Hillary Clinton image that originated in a white nationalist web forum. At the very least, Trump has not appeared to be all that reflective about his campaign's success in attracting anti-Jew supporters. Mm-hmm. Now let's get to the good stuff. On the other hand, Trump has an intimate familiarity with Jewish practice and Jewish life. His daughter, Ivanka, converted to Orthodox Judaism in 2009. Trump will be the first president to be a parent of and a grandparent of observant Jews. Ivanka's husband, real estate magnate Jared Kushner, is an Orthodox Jew and one of Trump's top advisors. The Trump Organization's longtime chief financial officer and general counsel are both observant Jews, and Trump has the support of perhaps the single most important political donor in the American Jewish world, Las Vegas casino mogul Sheldon Adelson. Though he is deeply repellent politically to many American Jews, Trump can plausibly claim that Jews and Judaism are closer to the center of his life and work than they are of his opponent, former Secretary Hillary Clinton. Trump favored Jews have a seemingly limitless confidence in their benefactor personal qualities. The Trump they know is decisive, serious, tolerant, and generous, and they formed their impressions out of years, even decades, of personal experiences with the man in business. Despite his special access, their belief in Trump himself, which is often independent of any ideological kinship, helps it demystify exactly why the real estate developer is so blatantly and viscerally unpalatable to tens of thousands of Americans, appeals to tens of millions of others. The Trump Jews also hint at some of Trump World's defining organizational tendencies. With the possible exception of Sheldon Adelson, every one of the major Trump Jews has known Trump for years, is personally friends with Trump, or is connected to his family through marriage. One of the Trump's Jews is known to be a registered Democrat. None of them was a leading Democrat donor who has tortured history. One of Trump's most dedicated surrogates. Trump's Jews reflect the importance of personal loyalty with Trump's political and moral universe, as well as a certain degree of diversity in ideology and background among the people who have come to believe in him. They can be divided into three circles of influence, which, save the candidate's daughter, Ivanka, don't overlap all that much. The loyalists of the Trump organization, the moneyed political world around the candidate Trump and the candidate's family. Of those circles, it seems fair to say that the Trump organization people have been with Trump the longest, while his family possesses the most direct influence with the candidate. Just 4 months ago, Jason Greenblatt was Trump's organizational general counsel and one of the company's top in-house legal officers. Today, Greenblatt, who has worked for Trump since the mid-1990s, is one of the candidate's top advisors on Israel and Jewish affairs and a campaign primary liaison to the Jewish community. When the Forward magazine declared a 24-hour moratorium on the Trump-related coverage on June 20th to protest Trump's supporters' online bullying of journalists, Greenblatt wrote the campaign's response, and when controversy erupted over Trump's use of the image of Hillary Clinton that had originated on a white nationalist web forum, Greenblatt defended the candidate in the Washington Post, citing his own experiences with Trump. Quote, "The clearest refutation of the claim of anti-Jewism by Trump, or the claim that Mr. Trump is someone who encourages, condones, or panders to anti-Jew behavior, is his lifelong embrace of the Jewish people and his record of staunch support for Jewish causes in Israel," Greenblatt wrote. Greenblatt, who is an Orthodox Jew, told Tablet that Trump has never made an issue of his Sabbath observance, letting him break the Shabbat during in-progress real estate negotiations, and accommodating his family's Sabbath observances during the visits to Mar-a-Lago. In Greenblatt's view, any perceptions of anti-Jewism among Trump or his supporters are the result of distorted media narratives and not any anti-Jewish bigotry that's endemic in the campaign. "The unease is misguided and misplaced," Greenblatt says, of Jewish nervousness towards Trump's alleged dalliances with anti-Jewism. Quote, "I hope that the people will figure that out. I think, truthfully, it's the responsibility of everybody to figure it out." Greenblatt had never worked in politics until Trump made him his campaign advisor, and he has no formal background in Middle East policy. Quote, "I'm not a political guy," he explained. "I'm only involved in politics now because of who I work for." Unquote. There's a lot more good stuff here, but I don't know what to tell you. Your right-wing conservative, especially your right-wing conservative racists out there that think you've got a big friend in Donald Trump, as far as the Jewish question is concerned, and the way he sounds, as far as the black situation is concerned, and promising the blacks everything and going to rebuild their cities and neighborhoods and all that kind of crap. And I think he probably will go overboard in doing that kind of stuff. I don't know. You shouldn't be involved in this stuff. No self-respecting white separatist should be involved with this bullshit on either side. As I've said before, you can't be a good white separatist and play ball with these people. He's got Friedman, David M. Friedman, working for him, too. Friedman, a bankruptcy attorney who first began working for Trump roughly 15 years ago and who represented Trump during his bankruptcy proceedings, related to Trump brand of business ventures in Atlantic City, is the real estate developer's other top-ranking Israel advisor. Along with Greenblatt, Haaretz newspaper named him as the lead candidate to be Trump's ambassador to Israel, a former columnist for the right-wing Israeli website Arutz Sheva, Friedman is highly skeptical of the two-state solution. He is president of the American Friends of Bet Al, which is a West Bank settlement that sits just north of Ramallah and that is unlikely to remain under Israel control in the event of a peace agreement with the Palestinian Authority. Well, this thing goes on and on and on about all his Jewish buddies. Michael Cohen, Trump's special counsel and executive vice president, wasn't able to vote for his boss in New York's April 19th Republican primary. Cohen is a registered Democrat. A decade as Trump's primary spokesman, gatekeeper, and personal lawyer have put him at the center of the Republican presidential politics, a registered Democrat. It's such a bunch of shit, boys and girls. If you buy into any of it, you're just wasting your time and showing your ignorance. Cohen, whom ABC News once described as Trump's pit bull, speaks in a sharp New York brogue and has something of a prickly reputation, as is arguably appropriate for someone acting as a first line of defense for such controversial public figure. It's a perception that Cohen apparently likes. Quote, if somebody does something Mr. Trump doesn't like, I do everything in my power to resolve it to Mr. Trump's benefit, unquote. Quote, if you do something wrong, I'm going to come at you, grab you by the neck, and I'm not going to let you go until I'm finished. Well, there's quite a bit more about him here. And Ivanka Trump, the 34-year-old daughter of Ivana and Donald Trump, is one of the Trump's campaign's most important centers of power. Ivanka was reportedly the driving force behind the removal of former campaign manager Corey Wilodowski last month. Ivanka was said to be very impressed during her individual meetings with senators after Donald Trump's awkward and occasionally hostile sit-down with congressional Republicans on July 7th. A meeting that reportedly included a tense exchange between Trump and Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. As the New York Times reported in April, Ivanka holds an exalted position in the family, in their company, and even the campaign, serving as a trusted advisor and a surrogate political spouse. In light of Melania Trump's aversion to the campaign trail, on the business side, Ivanka has negotiated the Trump Organization's acquisition of a luxury golf resort in Miami and its renovation of the old post office complex near Washington, D.C. Here's one, too. Jared Kushner, when now 35-year-old son of Charles Kushner married Ivanka Trump, he probably had a little idea the union would eventually turn him into one of the top players in American politics, according to the July New York Times report. Kushner is one of Trump's closest advisors and serves as a de facto campaign manager, brokering high-level meetings and mapping out damage control strategies after incidents like Hillary Clinton's Jewish Star tweet. He reportedly authored much of Trump's well-received AIPAC speech from his past April, the first of the campaign in which the Republican candidate spoke with aid of a teleprompter. Kushner is also the owner and publisher of the New York Observer, which endorsed Trump before the New York primary in April in an editorial with the unforgettable frank opening, quote, Donald Trump is the father-in-law of the Observer's publisher. That is not reason to endorse him, giving millions of disillusioned Americans a renewed sense of purpose and opportunity is. Well, the new president doesn't have Jews around him, like all the other presidents. Maybe he's got more. And there's the father of Donald Trump's son-in-law, Charles Kushner. In 2004, Kushner was investigated for hiding violations of federal limits on campaign contributions, a probe that Christie oversaw while he was U.S. Attorney for New Jersey. Maybe that's the reason Christie got the job of getting Trump all set up in the White House. Kushner then hired a prostitute in order to blackmail one of the case's key witnesses, whose wife then informed investigators of Kushner's attempts at obstruction of justice. To make matters worse, the witness and target of blackmail attempt was Kushner's brother-in-law, and it was Kushner's sister, Esther, who exposed his plot to the feds. The campaign finance investigation stemmed from a dispute between Kushner and his brother, Murray, a major New Jersey Republican donor and one of Chris Christie's most important boosters. Charles Kushner served 14 months in prison, but remained a major philanthropic donor in the Northeast Jewish circles. In 2015, he donated $100,000 to Trump's Make America Great PAC. 15 years earlier, he had been the largest individual donor to Hillary Clinton's Senate campaign. Then it goes into all the Jew donors, big shot Jew donors. I guess that's enough of that for now. You get the idea? Now, I assume Plastic Man has a computer. I assume Plastic Man reads some of this stuff, or he should, before he opens his mouth, because he's put himself right in the lap of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump has put himself right in the lap of world Jewry and all of those people. So, I don't know, man. If you're still sending money to that guy, you've got to be nuts. The press love these stories. A 25-year-old Las Vegas man whose National Socialist, Hollywood National Socialist tattoos were covered with makeup during a robbery trial was sentenced this week to up to 9 years in prison. Beisel Morgan must serve a minimum of 3.5 years in prison for his conviction, according to a sentence handed down Tuesday by District Judge Richard Scotty. Defense lawyer David Figler said he planned to appeal the conviction. Quote, "This is a very complicated case for a young man who is accused of serious offenses." Morgan is also facing the death penalty in a Northwest Valley slaying of a 75-year-old woman that occurred just days before the robbery. All these issues, especially when you're dealing with the death penalty, are extremely complex, Figler said, and no one should ever rush to the ultimate judgment. A different judge is expected to set a trial date for the capital case on Thursday. A swastika within a clover is permanently etched under Bizzell Morgan's left eye. The words "Most Wanted" are scrawled across the 25-year-old's forehead, and "Baby Nazi" is tattooed on his neck. Two more white supremacist tattoos are located where his eyebrows should be. Morgan gained international media attention earlier this year after a different Scotty ordered the tattoos covered for trial. So they covered up these tattoos for trial. Well, this is the idiocy of the right-wing types. I mean, it's absolute insanity. Who's going to be serious and get racial tattoos all over their face or any kind of tattoo? But, of course, the racialists get the blame for all of this. You know, this is all our fault. This is all... It's not just weird and weird's fault. It's our fault. Portugal arrests 20 members of the neo-Nazi group Hammerskin Nation. The Lisbon District Prosecutor's Office said in a statement those detained were part of the Hammerskin Nation, a Nazi skinhead group. Well, I'm telling you, boys and girls, from what everything I hear, that this Hammerskin Nation and these other people, a lot of other people, skinheads, are heavily into drug trafficking. And you can't be a part of a real white separatist movement if you're into heavy drug trafficking and a lot of other nonsense. I'm telling you, skinheads started out to be a good idea, but they haven't ended up that way. Here we go again. The election of Donald Trump is being celebrated by Greece's ultra-nationalist Golden Dawn Party, a movement known for its rabid anti-Jewism and anti-immigration stance. Quote, in the American elections, the forces which are fighting against globalism are fighting against illegal migration and are in favor of clean ethnic states, in favor of self-sufficiency in the national economy. The party spokesman was quoted by Reuters as saying in a televised statement, I wish these people would do their homework before they come out and back people. The leader of the party announced Golden Dawn support for Trump in October, saying his candidacy represented a patriotic wind in the United States, where it appears that the next president will be a patriot president, a president who doesn't want illegal immigrants into his country. Well, that's true. That's true. But it was a rising of the working class. Primarily, whether Trump's around or not, it was a rising of the working class, the white working class. But these organizations like that who come out promoting Trump are going to have egg on their face as time goes on.
Pittsburgh SWAT brought in a police dog to take down a rape suspect in Hazelwood this morning. Now, we first told you about Lee Harris last night on 11 at 11. Officers found him hiding out in an apartment on Gertrude Street. Police say he attacked a woman on Forbes Avenue in Uptown, forced her into an abandoned building, and raped her at knife point. The victim told police Harris attacked her because she was white.
Well, the Black Ku Klux Klan were active this last weekend. Last weekend was a tragic one in Chicago. It was also typical. Four people were killed by gunfire. Another 15 were wounded. Halloween weekend was similar. 6 dead, 15 wounded. October was Chicago's second most violent month this year. Those terrible statistics come despite the innovative program by Chicago Police Department, which uses an algorithm to predict not only who is likely to commit a violent crime, but also who is at great risk of dying in one. Frank Main has covered the crime for Chicago Sun-Times since 1999. He joins Here and Now's Robin Young in the first part of a two-part conversation about the algorithm's successes and failures. Well, that's another grand plan to stop the Black KKK and shoot it down.
Cops win, but nothing seems to impact the death toll in Chicago. This past weekend, 4 men were killed by gunfire, 15 more were wounded. Halloween weekend, the tally was 6 dead, 15 wounded. October was Chicago's second most violent month this year, 78 murders, 353 shootings. And those statistics come despite an innovative program being used by the Chicago Police Department to determine who's likely to commit a violent crime or die in one, to then find them and try to save their lives or the lives of their potential victims. It's an algorithm, but looking at the statistics, it doesn't seem to be working. Frank Main has covered crime for the Chicago Sun-Times for years and says that the violence in Chicago is as bad now as it was when he started 17 years ago. He joins us from the newsroom at the Sun-Times. Frank, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And start with the algorithm. Tell us a little more about it, who was behind it, and how it was supposed to work.
So this was a long time coming, and there's a particular fellow who had a lot to do with it. His name is Andrew Papachristos. Back in 2002, I met him because he was working at the National Gang Crime Center and was out in the street doing research on gangs. And so as far back as 2010, he and some other researchers started looking at Chicago and trying to see whether they could apply kind of network strategy to solving crime in Chicago.
Well, this is just fascinating to us because not only was he a guy from Chicago, his mother dealt with gangs. She was a social worker. You know, it sounds like, you know, a Chicagoan who really almost crafted his career to try to help this problem.
That's true. And so he looked at this thing a couple different ways, and one of them was that he went to the west side of Chicago, and he saw that there was a very small number of people who were in a network of individuals who were at super high risk of getting killed. So essentially, he looked at a neighborhood that had about 80,000 people in it, and he found a network of about 1,600 people who were at the highest risk of getting murdered. And he found, you know, just like in 6 degrees of separation, he found that many of these people were a handshake away from their killers. I mean, they knew the people who were likely to kill them. They were in, you know, a high-risk lifestyle. And what was interesting about his research there is that some people wrote off these entire communities as being dangerous and, you know, everybody in the community was at high risk of being killed. So he said, well, if we really drill down into these neighborhoods, maybe we can apply some strategies to save those people.
This led to what's now called the strategic subject list. And your police chief there agrees, your police superintendent, Eddie Johnson, he says, we know there's a small segment that's driving this, which
that's
was,
right.
You know, off of this research.
But the history actually goes back to 2013. The previous police superintendent, Gary McCarthy, actually launched this thing. And he kind of created a hybrid of what Andrew Papachristos wanted to do. He used it to also identify potential offenders, so people who might shoot and kill other people. And so they tried to create this, like you said, strategic subject list based on an algorithm that would use all sorts of factors to try to predict, you know, who was most likely to engage in violence, as well as who might be a victim.
Well, talk about some of those factors, because it's not race and it's not neighborhood. It's things like what? Arrests and convictions?
So some of the things that might make you at risk would be that you had a previous violent crime in your background or violent crimes. You might be a gang member. You might be in a certain age group
right.
that might be more likely to commit violence. The thing is about this particular algorithm that the university that designed it and the Chicago Police Department won't talk specifically about what's in the algorithm. They'll talk generally about what it does.
And when you say the person who designed it, Miles Wernick is a professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology. He created the algorithm again off of Andrew Papachristos at Yale's research. Okay, so when it's first drawn up, just start there. A lot of people worried about this. It seems like it's targeting somebody for a crime they haven't committed.
Right. Future crime, right? So it really raised a lot of eyebrows when they first talked about this. But what it really does is it has allowed the police to knock on a very small number of doors of people who they believe are at the highest risk of either being killed or killing somebody.
Okay, tell us about that part of the program. The police commander visits people pinpointed by the algorithm to tell them the risk they're at. How's that working?
The last time I addressed this issue was a couple months ago, and I was told that since 2010 they had essentially made contact with about 950 people who were gang members and were on this SSL list. So if you think about that, I mean, it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the total number of gang members in Chicago, which, you know, are estimated at least 100,000 in Chicago. The people who run this program, of course, believe that this is working, and they say about 11% of these people that they met with became victims of a shooting after one of these visits. So, in other words, you know, 1 in 10 did not become victims. They also said that 20% of the people that they contacted committed a new act of violence. So, you know, 2 in 10 committed an act of violence. And then 19% of these people reached out for help. So the third component of this program is to have people who they consider to be influential in your life, like your pastor or your coach or somebody who you respect, also at the door with the police commander and offering to get you help in terms of job counseling services, that kind of thing. And, you know, not everybody takes them up on that. And in fact, in talking to people who have actually been visited by these folks, a lot of these young guys tell me that they were kind of wary of what the police were up to. You know, they thought that they were essentially just being targeted by the police instead of being offered a helping hand. So there's still a lot of distrust. So what's happening now, I mean, with these 600-plus murders that are going on right now in Chicago, is that there are a whole host of different reasons why that's happening. And this program, I would have to say, is just one small way to address it, you know?
Well, later this week, we're going to explore those other factors, including how many gangs there are in Chicago. Wow, 100,000 members. That's Frank Main, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, who covers crime. Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, we'll take another look on Thursday.
Well, I see the KKK's at it. Marching on a bridge down in Mebane, North Carolina this morning, supposedly. Can the KKK do anything right anymore? Actually, the only real Klan was Reconstruction Klan. That's the one I like. That's the kind of thing that could win it for whites in this country. But it seems like right-wing KKK always picked the wrong way to do things. And parading, you know, you can hate Hillary, which is easy. She's so bad. But to come out pushing Trump like they do is suicide. But they're going to keep doing it. Whenever there's a right-wing throws them a bone, they're going to go for it.
So can you tell me just why you guys are out here today?
I'm out here today because we as Americans have taken God out of America. I believe that at Trump, America would be great for America. I'm just here exercising my First Amendment right as a Christian. And these people here expressing the same we've got people, I've got people there waving, people that are giving us thumbs up. I've had people give us one finger gesture. Whether they can't get all of their fingers up at once or not. But I don't understand holding the Christian flag and the American flag, what exactly they're flipping off, you know? Either they're flipping off Jesus Christ or they're flipping off America. I don't understand.
Another day in the life of the KKK. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, hopefully. Let's see, this is, what is today? This is the November the 10th. Yeah, November the 10th. And it's Stores Day. And we're out of here, baby. Keep on trucking, KKK. You choose the wrong thing all the time. Actually, evidently, that guy that was talking there was on one side of the street and the racial people were on the other side of the street. So he was just there to promote Jesus and God.
And the white man is the boldest creature on this planet. The white man has more nerve than the fucking toothache. That's why you can go to space and do all that shit. You will crawl into a can of beans. I get in. Because I saw a special, you know, early in the morning, like 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning, when you think niggas are asleep, I'm up. They have specials on white men do crazy shit. I saw a white man in a cage deep in the ocean fucking with a big old white shark. That shit was scary. And the shark just kept hitting it. The white man was down there just freaking. They brought him up and shit, interviewed him. It was wonderful. Marvelous. The shark was white, I was white, there was no niggas I loved. That's some funny, wild-ass bullshit. Because you guys do things that niggas want to, and the white folks are nosy. They have specials. Nosy specials. Why does a bee make honey? You ain't a bee. Why do you give a fuck? Following in a butterfly to Mexico. Just crazy shit. Nosy. That's why you can go to the moon and shit. They tell me they sent a black girl somewhere, didn't they? They said they sent a black girl up there, but I didn't never hear them say they brought that bitch back. Because did they send a married couple? I saw them on the news. I ain't seen that black woman. There's a coon on the moon in June. The jig is up. Shit was cold. I hope they bring that bitch back. Because didn't Russia leave somebody up there? They sent somebody up there. They was too broke. They couldn't bring this motherfucker back. Because the country fell apart. The economist, she called it back. Conrad, Conrad. They said, I'm sorry, he's moved. He went to America. Conrad. Some cold shit. But it is. It's, but white people do that. You do wild stuff. That's it. And I'm now that we're all friends, and I want to ask white folks, why do you guys take your children to places where they can get attacked and eaten and shit? I'm tired of picking up paper reading about some little white child carried off by a bear, a mountain lion, some coyotes, wolves. You take your kids. You never read about black kids being taken away by some wild shit. You guys are freaks for doing that shit. And then when the bear gets your kids, you try to get all psychological. What motivated the bear? The bear was hungry. Your child looked like a hamburger. That's what's the motivation. And you shouldn't have been out there in the woods. Y'all are crazy. Let your kids play in the eagle's nest. Play with the eggs. You know the eagle coming back to fuck them up.